Welcome to the Healthcare Plus podcast, hosted by Quint Studer and Dan Collard. I'm Nicole Webb-Bodie, partner at Healthcare Plus Solutions Group. Thank you for joining us as we bring together leaders and changemakers from across the healthcare industry. In each high-impact segment, you'll hear about the latest challenges organizations are facing and learn how guests are rewiring solutions to drive real change. Plus, you'll walk away from each episode with practical tools, techniques, and best practices to implement in your own role and in your organization. For more information on your host or to listen to recent episodes of the podcast, please visit www.healthcareplussg.com/podcast. Now, I'm pleased to welcome today's host, Dan Collard, who will introduce you to our next guest.
Well, hi, everybody. This is Dan Collard, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Plus podcast. It seems like every time we do one of these, we talk about it being a really special episode. And this is yet another really special episode, because you're not only going to find this episode on the Healthcare Plus Solutions Group website, you're going to find this podcast on a brand new website. And we'll tell you more about that before we end the podcast today. But it's a really special opportunity for us to introduce a brand new organization. And we'll introduce the members of this new organization, but the name of the new organization is the Post-Acute Leadership Institute, PALI for short. And joining us today on this podcast, myself, Quint Studer, Tracy Jansen, and Nick Porter. I'm going to ask Tracy and Nick to introduce themselves first, and then we're going to get in to talk about where this new organization came from, why it came to be, and what we hope to accomplish with the new organization. So first of all, Tracy and Nick, welcome, and it's so great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Tracy, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and then, of course, the connection into this entity we're going to call the Roundtable.
Absolutely. So great to be with you guys today. I have been in the post-acute industry coming up, I think, on 20 years, not to date myself, but previously as chief HR officer for Golden Living, Consulate, and Signature, probably when they're at their largest. More recently, now I've transitioned to becoming the COO at the Executive Roundtable for the post-acute executives in the HR space, and got to meet Quint and Dan more recently, and to talk about, the challenges that we're facing with leadership. And that's where this solution is coming into play.
Awesome. Great to have you here. Nick.
Yeah. So Nick Porter, glad to be here. I've been in the healthcare industry for going on probably 12 years now, heavily focused in the human resources space, very similar to Tracy. I've worked in both the acute care side as well as the post-acute industry for the last probably 8 years. I have some background in the industry and worked as a vice president of human resources for Signature Healthcare for a number of years. About 18 months ago or so, Tracy and I took this journey leading the Roundtable group. So I am kind of by de facto the CEO of the Post-Acute HR Executive Roundtable. Thanks for having us.
And we've got one more thing in common, Nick. You're in Pensacola, Florida, much like Healthcare Plus Solutions Group.
Yes, sir.
Well, Nick, I want to start with you as we think about the Roundtable, as you described first, the voices of the Roundtable, these folks that come in from various post-acute organizations. They were focusing on what happens if we don't do anything new? What if we don't do anything different? Sort of the risk of inaction. And you, as a group of roundtable leaders, reached out to us, reached out to Healthcare Plus Solutions Group to see if we could solve the challenges potentially together. Now, let's talk about when you're in the space and you're very well connected to a lot of the larger owner, operator, investors in post-acute. When you're having these conversations with the CEOs and the conversation goes to doing things the way we've always done them or potentially doing things new, What do you hear from these leaders, and how did that sort of help in the run-up of the decision to reach out to us for a potential partnership?
Yeah, so from I spend a lot of time talking to the investors within the industry as well as the CEOs within the industry. I've got that pleasure of kind of sitting at the table with them and trying to come up with unique ideas, or at least figure out, you know, really what their struggles are. And quite frankly, everybody was in such survival mode moving through COVID and turning over every single rock that they can turn over to really try to figure out how to kind of survive from a company perspective. And so there was less real focus on the culture and more focus on, okay, how do we just kind of get through the day-to-day? A lot of those owners, CEOs, you know, now that we're kind of coming out of the COVID component, they're trying to figure out a way now to come back and engage, because what they're really seeing is that the vast majority of dollars that are just completely being wasted are on complete and utter turnover issues. And so, you know, as a group of collective, they're really trying to figure out, okay, where do we invest? How do we invest? And how do we really train up our leaders in order to kind of reduce that turnover component?
You know, Nick, it's sort of interesting when you think of the news coverage back during the pandemic. You know, staffing clearly affected the entire healthcare continuum. But it just seems like the folks in the post-acute space didn't get nearly as much attention on the nightly news, on the documentaries, et cetera. Any idea why you think that was?
Yeah, you know, there was honestly a huge shift in kind of focus, again, around kind of day-to-day survival. And quite frankly, you know, during the pandemic, you really didn't want to be on the news as much. And so, you know, the nursing home industry typically has, or the post-acute industry typically has fallen kind of behind in terms of order of importance. Hospitals kind of always get that notoriety. They're always kind of first and foremost. At the end of the day, you know, the post-acute industry is a very thin margin business. You know, there's really only a couple of different revenue streams that come in the door from a post-acute perspective. And it's a growing population. It's going to continue to be a growing problem within this industry. But again, through COVID, everybody was just in survival mode, trying to get through the day to day.
So, Tracy, we had a chance to meet the members of the roundtable. We had a chance to spend a couple of days in Asheville, North Carolina recently with you as the leaders and the members of the roundtable. And I remember we started off by asking a question that was really a fill in the blank question, because I don't think we could have actually filled in the blank. We asked them specifically if they were to describe how post-acute leadership had been viewed pre-pandemic. So what was it like even before the pandemic hit? And it was sort of interesting, the answers we heard from around the table, from the actual post-acute leaders themselves. Some of the words that came to mind as they shared with us were interchangeable, less than, lacking. Can you give me an overview of the challenges that the post-acute industry is facing, not only post-pandemic, but even pre-pandemic, as we think about staffing shortages, the aging population, the need for additional space in the post-acute? What's your take on that, Tracy, as not only an industry veteran, but also a roundtable leader?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting when I think back on my tenure in the post-acute space, the challenges are the same. They've just been exacerbated by the pandemic. So, you know, first and foremost, we're the most highly regulated industry that exists, right? So that poses the challenge of always being under severe scrutiny, albeit it's important. We're caring for people in their most vulnerable state, but it does pose, you know, constant scrutiny and constant evaluation of processes and systems. And it doesn't always have a positive brand, right? When you think of nursing homes specifically in that piece of the post-acute spectrum, people don't always have favorable experiences, so it's difficult to overcome that. So that makes it really hard to recruit and retain, especially at the leadership level, to get those people who want to be, you know, providing a service to people, but then don't see it as maybe the most respected industry to serve in. And, you know, as Nick had mentioned, you know, the acute space seems to draw some of the, you know, greatest talent. And the post-acute space runs such razor-thin margins that even when we get some good talent, it's hard to keep it because we don't have the margins to continue to invest, or at least we don't think we do, right? We've always made the excuse of we can't afford to do that, when the reality is we can't afford not to. And so through the pandemic, all of those challenges were exacerbated. You know, the turnover that we sort of lived with and just assumed that, oh, we're always going to have high turnover in the nursing home side. And even with home health and hospice, we sort of accepted it. And then going into the pandemic, it just got worse. And to your point earlier, Dan, we were thankful when we didn't make the news, because the news meant some catastrophic things were happening within the homes during the pandemic. But everybody was focused on the acute space because that's where the initial care was being given when you were hospitalized for getting COVID. But we saw, you know, what I would describe as a mass exodus during and throughout the pandemic. And we're still recovering from that. People were leaving for, I think, three reasons: fear, right, for their own health and their family's health; fatigue, because they were just so burnt out. You know, the regulations were coming down daily and the things that they were having to live through and experience were just exhausting. And then opportunities elsewhere, right? So when we used to compete in the retail and service industry, you know, the Burger Kings and the Amazons and that, post-pandemic or even throughout the pandemic, the acutes started paying very high wages, right, to get travelers to come in. So our nurses started leaving the nursing homes. And then you saw agencies sort of kind of swell up and take advantage of that. And so premium labor got out of control. Even with our roundtable members, you heard from them last week that agency got as high as $750,000 a month in one organization. So these challenges just kept getting more and more difficult. And we all know that the leader of the facility, the branch, or the home sets the tone for the culture within that center. And they're the ones that connect to the home or corporate office to the field and the caregivers. And if we don't get that right, then we see it transcend into very high turnover, low morale. And so we're continually challenged by that. And of course, now to complicate things more, we have this silver tsunami that everybody's been talking about for years. And Nick, you mentioned it, right? It's only getting harder. So now census is growing, but guess what? We don't have the staff to care for that census. So we're finding our operators are telling us that they're having to turn away taking care of patients, which is a travesty, right? We're called to care for people. And we're having to say no, because we don't actually have the staff to be able to take care of them. And with this tsunami, they say that in 2030, there will be 1 billion people over the age of 65. So it's just this massive feat of how do we care for this population that we already have, those kind of turning that corner that are going to be knocking at our door, and how do we attract the talent and keep them? We seem to be doing better at getting people back in the door, but honestly, what we call that sort of churn or that early turnover in that first 90 days is not getting better. And so we're all compelled as a leadership group to kind of come together and say, help us. We need our leaders to grow and to be developed and for their wells to be filled, so that can spill over to getting the right people in the door and holding on to them.
Right. I you know, I want to bring Quint into the conversation here. It's not that we were necessarily doing anything wrong. It was just saying, hey, what's it look like in 2023, 2024, and beyond? And rewiring has been this theme for us since early last fall. And this whole approach of not necessarily doing things radically different, but finding out what's working and keeping it, and then finding out where you're not getting the outcomes and doing something about it. And the outcomes that I hear both you and Nick talking an awful lot about, selecting and retention, and really heavy focus on retention there. So it seems like almost a perfect illustration of eating our own cooking, as we've taken a look at the work we've done over on the acute side and rewired it to the needs of those organizations. Now it's an opportunity to do the very same thing. So Quint, as always, one of the first things that you jumped in to do was right. Capture the right thoughts, capture it into a way that it's doable, it's consumable. And we have a brand new book called Rewiring Leadership in Post-Acute Healthcare. What are your thoughts as we began to put the book together, and how can we make this work doable equally as well for the post-acute folks?
You know, when I look at this, Dan, this isn't new. I've been in this business from day one. when I was at Mercy Hospital in Janesville, Wisconsin, we had home health and hospice. When I was in Holy Cross in Chicago, we had a skilled nursing facility. When I was president of Baptist Hospital, we had, again, skilled nursing facility, retirement village, and so on. Almost all our previous work when I was with Studer Group, which of course now I'm no longer there, I'm with Healthcare Plus Solutions Group, we always worked with organizations that had a piece of subacute somewhere. And usually what would happen is we'd go to an organization, they'd implement all our stuff that were really geared for the acute world. And then they'd sort of, we can call it rewire, I'd call it jerry-rigging at the time, how this might work in their environment. But it was always a little more difficult. And most of our focus was really on the acute side for a number of reasons. That's where their bigger revenue was, their biggest dollars was, their biggest concern was, their reimbursement. So you'd look at a home health agency that would do some rounding. You'd look at a nursing, skilled nursing facility that would do some onboarding. But they're always trying to adjust to the acute and so on. But we always were interested in this, but we just never had really a venue to get in it the right way. So our hearts were always there. Our minds were always there, but we didn't know how. And so when Nick came and approached me about this from the roundtable, when the roundtable said one of their big challenges was or desires was leadership development. The first thing, I was so excited, and I want to commend all the operators out there, because, you know, when you look at operators, it really takes a lot of vision and passion and values to invest in what we're talking about. Because if you have to look upon development of skills as an investment, not an expense. And I just told the story the other day of an organization that had huge first year turnover. We offered to go in and do some development to reduce it. And they said, we just don't have time for training right now. We're so short staffed and we have all this turnover issues. And I think we're always dealing with the symptom instead of the cause. And I think this is a preventative cause to reduce some of the issues. And Tracy and I were talking the other day about human resources. I mean, they end up as a back end filter instead of the front end preventer. So, you know, when there's not documentation, when somebody was hired incorrectly, when the onboarding was so many left, HR ends up dealing with it. So this was really, I think, a really neat thing to work with Tracy and her team of taking this and saying, okay, there's some big differences in post-acute care. Let's just face it. It's harder. It's harder. And I know the acute people might not appreciate this statement, but it is harder. And I'll explain why. Number one, the spans of control are, I know they're large and acute, and some are very large, like med-surg. But in general, the span of control is pretty big in post-acute. Number two, the whole trust factor. You have to be better in post-acute. I was talking to somebody at the ACHE Congress in this field, and the question was trust. And I said, when you have somebody on the inpatient unit, of course, they want to be trustworthy, but normally a family member is with them most of the time. When you have someone in an outpatient procedure, a family member can be there. When you have somebody in post-acute, you're basically sometimes managing that loved one 24/7, 365, and the family, for all sorts of good reasons, can't be engaged. So I think what we did, and that's again to Nick and Tracy's credit, was dig in to listen to what these people said. And so they said, we want a way to people to develop skills, but it can't be a way that overwhelms them because they already have a lot in their plate. And we've got to do it in a cost-efficient manner for it to happen. And so that's really what led to look at, you know, rewiring leadership in the post-acute world needs, you have to narrow the scope. You have to focus much more, I think, on this employee engagement and onboarding than maybe in the acute world where you're also worried about OR turnover time and ER to bed. You don't have that. But you do, if you can just, what we plan on doing, increase retention considerably and reduce turnover, as Tracy and I talked about the other day, all sorts of other good things happen. So I'm really excited about the book. I think when post-acute people are going to read it, they're going to say, whoa, this was not a book that was written for somebody else and then just wiggled a bit for us. This is a book truly, and I don't know if there's other books, but It's truly a book completely geared toward people that work in the post-acute world.
I couldn't agree more. And as we think back about last Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in Asheville, when the book made its debut into the hands of some of these folks, it was so fun watching the excitement, because I got the sense that they really felt, just as Quint said, these folks are really paying attention to us. They're not trying to take something out of one language and simply run it through the Rosetta Stone and hope that it fits in a different language like that. Nick and Tracy, you were there firsthand. You, as the Roundtable founders, have known these members way longer than we have. I'd love to get just a couple of reactions from you about their reactions. What are some things you heard them, how you heard them react last week in Asheville?
Well, I can say that even before Asheville, when we mentioned that you guys were coming and that we were going to debut this new engagement, we literally had one person who was in leadership development for many years, OD background, was so excited that she was going to have the opportunity to meet the both of you live and in person. And she was hoping that she might get your autograph. And so it was really eye-opening for how many people who were already aware of your work that didn't operate in the acute space. So I think that was kind of refreshing to know that people were always looking, even if they couldn't afford the best of the best, they were always looking toward what great solutions, you know, could we employ if we could afford to have them, and how do we modify it for our space. And then again, at the event, even going through introductions before you all even had the opportunity to get in front of the group, almost every single person in their introduction and speaking about what they wanted to hear most about was all about PALI and what you guys were going to bring to the table. They were just astonished that the two of you were going to refocus your energies to our space, because for so long, so many have overlooked us. We just didn't get the attention necessarily that we had hoped for. And so this was extremely well received. So many have already expressed interest in, you know, how many people they're going to send. We did a survey after our event, and I think 8 or 9 have already expressed that they want to send 40 people, 50 people, all of my administrators, my regional team, some of my corporate teams. And then probably even to complement that more, a couple of the people at the table, our HR executives that we've been sitting beside for, you know, 15, 20 years, said, well, what about me? I'd like to sit in, I'd like to attend, because I would like to reinforce and be a part of kind of the rewiring of this, and knowing that I can help the sustainability of it within my organization. So it was just a true testament to how long we've needed it, how excited they are about what you have to bring to the table, and how committed they are to, you know, shaping the future of our space.
It was so fun to just feel the level of excitement in the room, and not excitement from just, you know, oh gosh, it's a new book, or, you know, these guys are going to be working with us. I just think it's such a personal part of our space. You know, as I was traveling home from Asheville, I posted on one of the social media channels that for me, it's also really personal, because I don't see residents. I don't see, you know, just this generic term in a bed in a skilled nursing facility or in a long-term acute care organization. I see my grandmother. And I'll never forget the first time that I went to visit my grandmother at her new home, a memory care facility in Anaheim, California. And, you know, I was scared to death. As her oldest grandson, her oldest grandchild, I'm worried about, did I let her down? What's it going to be like? And the minute I walked through the doors of that facility and I smelled nothing, I knew she was in the right place. They had hired an entire staff that, because of their own social culture, being from the Philippines, they honor their elders. And the way that I saw them care and love for my grandmother, and I just got to thinking, gosh, if we could replicate that in every post-acute organization across the industry, how cool would that be? Nick, I'd love to hear from you some of the reactions from the folks that you spoke with at the roundtable.
Well, I will say I completely echo, you know, Tracy's comments in terms of, you know, there was certainly some starstruck members last week, being able to kind of be in the same room as Quint and Dan for a few days. Again, everybody was just honored that, you know, y'all are bringing your expertise to this industry that just needs it so much. You know, I will say I'd be remiss if I didn't at least put it out there that post-acute is just it's such an amazing industry. The people are so amazing. The fact that there is a round table that exists within this industry where HR leaders from the biggest chains across the entire country all come together and talk about their problems and talk about, you know, what are the solutions? How can we as an entire industry, a collective, come together and help one another? Because we're all going through the same things. And so, you know, this group, it wasn't Tracy, it wasn't Nick, it was the members who came together and said, we need this. Does anybody have resources that we can, as a group, come together and build this content and as a team move the needle? So again, just to our membership, just recognizing this and the collaborative nature and spirit, I completely commend.
You know, one of those best examples was as we were writing the book, as we were rewiring, we didn't do it in a vacuum. We reached out through you and Ed and Mark and the rest of the folks at the roundtable to get really good input from the industry itself. And one of the things that we heard as an input is, you know, we've got to think also about what about that nursing home administrator as an example that belongs to a very large organization who's corporate office might be 500 miles away. And we added an entirely new chapter that didn't even exist in the original version of Rewiring. And that was about building local leadership muscle. And that idea that much like the rest of healthcare is local. And what does that local leader need to do to build good leadership muscle? So it's not just about waiting for somebody from the corporate office to send something down or always worry more about the regulatory side of the world versus sort of taking control of their own destiny. We call it being an owner versus a renter. And I love the reaction specifically to that chapter from everybody. And Quinn, it just reminds me one last thing I'd like to have you weigh in on. You just told the story before about 1,000 people at ACHE about your dad and the tie tack that he wore, where he worked and who that company was part of. And I think it's a perfect example of how these local post-acute leaders also have an obligation to help build trust in their workforce from perhaps these larger organizations that they don't see. Love to have you weigh in on that as one last item.
Sure. We're finding it's really common. It's common in all industries, not just post-acute, that you're a facility leader. You know, you're the president of a healthcare system, but it's regional and you're part of a big corporation. It's just a natural tendency to not just consciously make it frame the positivity of being part of the system. And like I said, I think to the group, we were working with a system that purchased 22 small rural hospitals and saved them. Yet the people were complaining about corporate headquarters asking them to do things. Well, they kept them alive. And one of the things we do real seriously is help people understand how fortunate they are to be part of a corporation, part of a bigger piece. And sometimes if we don't connect the dots, it doesn't come naturally because they think, well, this came down from high. This came down from here. This is from this city. And I think when you look at many of these, especially at the cash crunch, many of these post-acute facilities, what would they do if they didn't have access to capital? And they get access to capital between part of these larger organizations. Many of the benefit plans they wouldn't have available if they weren't part of these big organizations. Even in looking at technology, I guarantee you, I know talked about capital, and sometimes people think capital is brick and mortar, but capital with technology, I mean, they just wouldn't be even being available. They'd have to close down because, as you said, Tracy, this is the most regulated industry, healthcare industry there is. So what we always try to do is get people to feel good about not only where they work, but the bigger picture. And I'll close with my dad. My dad was a mechanic. He worked 41 years at a company called Electromotive, EMD is what it stood for, Electromotive Division. So in McCook, Illinois, we lived in Brookfield. In fact, you could overlook the quarry on the way there. It made diesel engines. And for at one time, 90% of every diesel, every train had an electromotive engine in it at one time. And my dad went to work at 19. He was a mechanic. He had his name, Quinn, on his, you know, sort of a white shirt with gray stripes, and it said Electromotive. And he retired at 60. And my dad was very loyal to where he worked. He loved being a mechanic. He was grateful that he got to do this work that he's passionate about. He probably couldn't have ever gone out on his own because, you know, my mother would have said, no, I don't think so. There's no security there. He worked at Electromotive. And I knew a schedule. He got off at 4:42 every morning, every night. We'd eat at 5 o'clock. It was like regimented. Well, every year they'd have the kids could go to Electromotive, and got nothing better than having your parent work in a factory that made train engines. My grandmother Nellie worked there. My uncle George worked there. My cousin Johnny worked there. I mean, we had a lot of relatives working at Electromotive. And what I say is, you might not recognize it, but the only in the front entryway, it said Electromotive. Then it had a division of General Motors. My dad never made a car, never made a truck, never was at a plant that was called General Motors. Yet he loved General Motors. And I wore a tie clip. When my dad had 30 years of service, they gave him a tie clip with three little sort of dot ring, you know, red, blue, yellow type things on it. And it didn't say Electromotive. It said General Motors. And my dad wore that tie clip. And I said, my dad loved General Motors. Why? Because somebody told him, because General Motors owns Electromotive, these are some of the benefits that you get from that. And when people would come into our driveway, if they didn't have a General Motors product, he felt you were taking food off the table. And what I tell people is, most post-acute places, supervisors, they like their boss, and they probably like where they work. And my dad loved his job and loved Electromotive. But how much more was his life enriched because he also liked General Motors? And I think as a facility leader, your job is to always authentically position the owner, the investor, in the post-acute care in a positive way. Because you want people to not only feel good about their job and the facility they're in, but the organization that they ultimately work for.
Thanks, Quint. It tells that story about why local leadership muscle is so key. So, you know, they say a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. We've taken that first single step together. We couldn't be more excited than to be partners with you all and your partners, Ed and Mark and others in this post-acute leadership institute. So what's next? What's next? If you're listening to this podcast, and especially if you're in the post-acute space, you can visit the new website. It's www.thepali.org. And let me spell that for you. thepali.org. That's the website. You can see things like our first event that's going to be in mid-July in Dallas, where we're going to gather these post-acute leaders for the first time. Our approach is going to be a real nice combination of high impact in-person sessions, and then virtual learning, but not just pre-recorded webinars, real live virtual learning with this first cohort of leaders with us across the year. And it's just one of those things that we're so excited to be able to see the impact. Because what I heard you say is there's really two pieces to this. There's the cultural piece, and then, of course, there's the financial survivability piece. And imagine what can happen if we bring those two together. If you'd like more information about anything that you've heard today, the email is info@thepali.org, thepali.org. And of course, PALI stands for Post Acute Leadership Institute. Tracy and Nick, great having you. Thanks for your gracious hospitality when we were together recently. Looking forward to everything that we can do together.
Well, I'm excited for this opportunity. Very grateful.
We'll see you on the next episode of the Healthcare Plus podcast.
If you would like free resources and access to our latest books, articles, and industry insights, visit our website at healthcareplussg.com. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue our journey to make healthcare better for caregivers, patients, and communities.